Today, we're starting a seven-week series that, as you can tell from the video that just played, is on Dinner with Jesus. And we're going to be focused primarily in the Gospel of Luke, looking at the meals that Jesus took part in. And we haven't done a series in any of the Gospels. This is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In any of those over the last probably 3 or 4 years that I can think of. And so I've been thinking about, well, I'd like to do a series in the Gospels, but what should we do? Should we go through a whole book? Should we find a specific part to focus on? How would we focus our attention within a book? And I came up with this idea of just focusing on the meals that Jesus took part in, primarily in the Gospel of Luke, though one Sunday we might look at a different Gospel account of a meal as well. If I were to ask you, or if someone were to ask you, how did Jesus go about doing his ministry? What would you answer? And I would imagine that a few different ideas would come to mind. You might say, well, Jesus spent a lot of time preaching and teaching about the kingdom of God, which is true. Or you might say, well, Jesus came and he came to heal and provide forgiveness for the diseased and the sinful and the demonic and the broken and the outcast. And this would be obviously true as well. In fact, the New Testament uses this phrase 3 times. The Son of Man came. And then it finishes that sentence in 3 different ways in the Gospel accounts. The Son of Man came doing what? Well, Mark 10:45 says the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So Jesus came to serve, to give of himself. And then Luke 19:10, the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. So Jesus came to save. Now, both of these first 2 statements are really a statement of why Jesus came, a statement of purpose. He came for a specific reason, to serve and to save. But the last one, the third one, in Luke 7:34, gets at a statement of how, of methodology. How did he go about serving and saving? Luke 7:34, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. That's how Jesus did his ministry. And we see meals all throughout the Gospel of Luke, many of which we will be looking at over these 7 weeks. Today's account is Luke 5, Jesus eating with tax collectors and sinners at a party that Matthew throws after he starts following Jesus. In Luke 7, in a story we'll look at in a couple weeks, Jesus is anointed by a sinful woman at the home of a Pharisee during a meal. In Luke 9, Jesus feeds 5,000, which is probably more like 10,000 people, a story we'll look at next week. In Luke 10, Jesus eats in the home of Martha and Mary. In Luke 11, Jesus condemns the Pharisees and the teachers of the law while eating at a meal with them. In Luke 14, Jesus is at a meal and he teaches a parable about a meal called the parable of the great banquet, teaching about not just inviting your friends, but inviting those who've been outcast, those outsiders, to the meals that you host. In Luke 19, Jesus invites himself to a meal at the house of Zacchaeus. In Luke 22, Jesus hosts a meal that we call the Last Supper. And in Luke 24, the risen Christ has a meal with 2 disciples after walking with them along the road to Emmaus. And then later that evening, he has a meal of fish with the disciples in Jerusalem. The meals that Jesus shared weren't just about food, though. They pointed to something beyond the meal itself. They were glimpses into this new kingdom that he was bringing with him. They were more than just symbolic. They embodied what the kingdom was like and how it would function. So the meals aren't just ideas or theories. They're a tangible experience. Think about sitting down for a meal. It's not just an idea or a theory. You eat the food. It's something you taste and you digest and take in. And it's more than even just about the food at a table. You're sitting around a table with other people. So it's also about the who is present as well. In his book about Jesus eating and drinking in the Gospel of Luke, Tim Chester, who's a British pastor, said this: his mission, Jesus' mission, strategy was a long meal stretching into the evening. He did evangelism and discipleship around a table with some grilled fish, a loaf of bread and a pitcher of wine. That was the methodology, the focus of how Jesus did his ministry. So before we get into our passage out of Luke 5 this morning, I want to issue an invitation or a challenge to all of us as a church, that while we're going through the series, Dinner with Jesus, for these 7 weeks, I want to invite you or challenge you to host a meal in your home with somebody who is not in your family and not a part of our church. Host a meal in your home with somebody who is not a part of our family or a part of your church. Now, I know some of you have logistical challenges to host a meal in your home. And so for those of you that find that difficult, maybe it's the preparing food, then I'd say order takeout and convince them you cooked it. They'll be really impressed. And if hosting a meal in your home is impossible, then you invite somebody to go out to your favorite restaurant and you pay for them. You pay for them and invite them to a meal. Those are two different ways that you could accomplish this. And the whole goal for hosting this meal is to invite spiritual conversations. Jesus did this by asking questions, like the question he asked to some of the disciples before he invited them to follow him. He asked, "What do you want?" It's a question of desire. What is it that you really want in life? That's a question that Jesus asked. And I know the idea of asking or inviting a spiritual conversation around a meal for many of you feels daunting because you are convinced, likely through many of your own experiences, that people are turned off or antagonistic toward the Christian faith. And they don't want to hear about anything that you believe and that is foundational to your life. But I actually want to encourage you that people are far more open to spiritual conversations than I think many of us realize and embrace. And some information has come out in the last few weeks that's really encouraging to me and I think can be a reminder to us that things in our society around faith and spirituality are shifting in a really an encouraging way. Barna is a company that does some research around religion and spirituality, and they had a survey over these last 5 years that showed that there's been a 12% increase of people who say this: "I have made a personal commitment to follow Jesus that is still important in my life today." 12% increase of people that are saying that now than compared to 5 years ago. Now, I know you might be like, 12% doesn't seem like a lot, but that's tens of millions of people that are represented by that number of people that are saying faith is more important and foundational to my life now. That's a huge and encouraging number. And then there is another study by the Bible Society in the UK that came out around church going. And the part that I want you to see is that it was Gen Z that was largely causing an increase in church going within society in Britain. And what they showed is that back in 2018, only 4% of Gen Z was actively going to church. And now in 2024, 6 years later, 16% of Gen Z were going to church. A 12% increase, again, represented by millions of people who are prioritizing faith. And one of the things that I think we should see, especially those of us who are older, what this represents is a changing, a shift that's taking place in Western societies around the world as it relates to the Christian faith. And this is largely being pushed by Gen Z. This is 18 to 28-year-old youth and young adults in early adulthood who are embracing faith that is causing a shift around the Christian faith happening around the world. It's really incredible. And so I know some of us can kind of assume like younger people aren't really prioritizing faith and they're going to be the reason why faith starts to fall apart and you're really worried. But I think you should be greatly encouraged that it is younger people who are largely causing an influx of Christian faith to happen in our society. The beginning signs of revival are being seen in our country and around the world, largely through 18 to 28-year-olds. Just incredibly encouraging news for the future of our faith. And so we're going to be focused on meals, and I want to invite you to host a meal and to invite a spiritual conversation, because I think meals are a natural setting for building relationships, because they invite people to slow down and to be present. A table creates space for honest and informal conversation that allows people to open up in ways that a more structured setting often does not. So there's something disarming about sitting down at a table and sharing a meal that breaks down barriers and helps people to connect on a human level in conversation. And so to start this series, we're going to look at the first meal in the Gospel of Luke. Luke chapter 5, a short section of verses 27 through 32 in Luke 5, in the middle of the chapter, where Luke writes this. He says, "After this, after Jesus had healed a paralyzed man, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting at his tax booth. 'Follow me,' Jesus said to him. And Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. Then Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, who belonged to their sect, complained to his disciples, 'Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?' Jesus answered them, 'It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance.'" This is the word of the Lord. Now, you might be wondering, as we just read that account, who Levi is. And you're thinking through all the names of the disciples that you remember, and Levi is not one of them. Well, it's important to point out that Levi is a Hebrew name that has a Greek name that is often referred to as Matthew. So in Matthew 9, the gospel that Matthew himself wrote, he is writing about himself, the same account that Luke just wrote about that we read in Luke chapter 5. Levi didn't have a name change like Paul or other people in the Bible to symbolize this transformation. He is just simply referred to by his Hebrew name and his Greek name almost interchangeably in the gospel accounts. And so we're going to work through this meal that Matthew hosts in his home after following Jesus. And we're going to look at a few different things, but really foundational to the story and why there's such a strong reaction against what Jesus does is because Jesus dines with sinners. That's the whole focus of this meal. Jesus dines with sinners, and the religious leaders don't like it. They ask him, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" And I use sinners here in the notes in quotations because that's what Jesus was accused of doing by the religious leaders. They saw the other people as the sinners and them as the righteous. After Jesus had asked Matthew to follow him, Matthew responded by throwing a party, a feast, and a lot of his friends show up. In verse 29, it says that there was a large crowd that was present at the party. But the problem the religious leaders have with the party is not that there's a party, it's the people who are at the party. That's what they don't like about what Jesus and his disciples are doing. And the reason why is because tax collectors were known to be against the Israelite people, the Hebrew people. They were seen to be sellouts. Nobody liked them because they were people of Israel, Hebrew descent, who had taken jobs working for their oppressor, the Roman government. Tax collectors were hired by Rome to collect taxes off of income and then to collect taxes, much like tariffs are today, collect taxes on goods that are being sold and imported into a city or in a region. Matthew worked in the city of Capernaum. Capernaum is located on the north side of the Sea of Galilee, a little ways away from Jerusalem. And Capernaum was also the location, one of the few Israelite towns that the Via Maris ran through. The Via Maris was an international highway that stretched all the way from Egypt in the south through Israel up to Syria in the north, meaning that there was a lot of goods that passed right through Capernaum. So there was a lot of money exchanging hands and a lot of opportunity for a tax collector to collect money for Rome and then to skim a little off the top. And that was part of why they were so hated, is they had a reputation that they could take their cut and more because they had so much power given to them by the Roman authorities. In fact, one Bible scholar wrote this based on a historical account. He said, "So rare was honesty in the profession of being a tax collector that a Roman writer once saw a monument to an honest tax collector." Meaning it was so rare that an honest one needed to be honored and recognized for just doing their job in the right way. So they weren't liked, and in part because of their dislike, and in part because they sometimes had to work on Sundays, they were banned from worshiping in the temple. They weren't allowed to worship in that space. And back then, just like it is now, when you share a meal with someone, you are communicating to that person and the people around you a sense of camaraderie and friendship and belonging toward that person. So these people that were hated and despised by the society, Jesus was making space for, and they didn't like it. In fact, one theologian describes this focus of Jesus. He says, in Luke's gospel, Jesus got himself killed because of the way he ate. Now, what they have in mind there is not Jesus' dinner mannerisms. He has in mind who Jesus ate with. Who Jesus ate with, who he associated with, which we see in Luke 5. And what's so convicting about this to me is that Jesus was well established in the religious society of his day. He knew all of the religious leaders. He had grown up with them. He had been taught and instructed alongside of them. They all knew each other. And Jesus goes outside of his community and makes space for people that aren't allowed in like he is. And I find that instructive because meals are inherently an inefficient use of time. They take a long time. They're largely very expensive to host. And Jesus makes time and space for people outside of his community in an inefficient way because he wants to express love and compassion. I read this week that 60% of Americans prefer takeout instead of dine-in at a restaurant. And the number one reason why was time. To eat in at a restaurant just takes too much time. We want meals to go a little faster because we're all about efficiency and speed. And so a meal where you're sitting down with another person, it takes time. It's an inefficient use of time. And Jesus is teaching something about how we should use our time by sharing a meal with sinful people, according to the religious leaders. And one of those sinful people we see who is throwing the party and is a focal point of our story is Matthew. And the way Matthew responds is Matthew lacks a fallback plan. He's all in. Jesus said to him, "Follow me." And in verse 28, it said, "Levi got up, left everything, and followed Jesus." When Jesus called Matthew to follow him, he wasn't just offering Matthew like a new direction on his life. He was upending Matthew's life. He was inviting him into a deep, significant fellowship, and he was inviting him into a complete surrender. It said that he left everything. Now, unlike other disciples who were fishermen who could leave their job and then pick it up later if things with Jesus didn't work out, Matthew left behind a career as a tax collector, a career that he wasn't going to be able to take up again once he turned his back on the Roman authorities and left his job. He couldn't just come back to it. He burned that bridge. He left his life of comfort and of security and stability. He staked everything on Jesus, trusting that the road ahead of following Jesus would be better than anything that he left behind. And I think that's what the text is getting at when it says he left everything, that there was no fallback plan. He was all in. And isn't this quite a bit different than how we can often think about following Jesus? I think a lot of times when it comes to following Jesus, we want Jesus to fit on the edges of our lives. Just give us a nice encouraging word every now and then, but everything else in the core of our lives, the way we spend our time and how we live our lives, we don't really want Jesus to touch. We'll come to church when our schedules open up on the weekend, and we'll give to the Lord in some capacity once our bank account is full, and we'll serve and find ways to care for others once our lives are in a pretty comfortable, stable place. We want to fit Jesus right on the corner of our lives, only when he fits in and is convenient. But what Matthew shows us is that when he walked away from the money table, he walked into a relationship of true meaning and purpose. He wasn't thinking about what he left behind. He was taking hold of something greater. Following Jesus might cost you comfort, convenience, control, but what you get based on what you give up is something far greater. The presence of Christ, the joy of the purpose that he brings, and the hope of an eternal kingdom and living forever. The call to leave everything isn't just about losing. It's also about gaining something that truly lasts and is sustained. So what would it look like for you and I then to leave everything? What could that practically look like in our lives? Well, I think it could look like choosing integrity at work, even when it might cost you a promotion. It could look like giving up your never-ending to-do list in order to carve out more time to spend with Jesus in prayer and in studying his word. It could look like giving up the need for approval and being liked by everybody around you while you take a stand for your faith. It could look like giving up your addiction to busyness and always adding more and more and more stuff into your life. It could look like giving up your grip or need for financial security, to relinquish that, to be able to be generous to God and others. Leaving everything behind doesn't always have to look like leaving your job or quitting everything and moving to the far reaches of the world to proclaim Christ. It could look like that, but it doesn't have to look like that. It could be very simply just letting go of the things that have a grip on your life so that you can take a greater hold of Jesus. And the beauty of what Jesus does here with Matthew, who leaves everything behind, is that Jesus invites Matthew in the midst of his sinful brokenness. Jesus is calling sinful, broken people, and that's because Jesus is, last point here, a physician to follow. Jesus is a physician to follow, and he describes himself in this way at the end of our passage. He says, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." Isn't it interesting that when Matthew follows Jesus, his very first thing that he does is he throws a big party, a feast at his house, and he invites all of his old friends to come and hang out with this new guy in his life named Jesus. And Jesus, what he doesn't do is stand off to the side and kind of look at Matthew and say, "You know what, like, now that you're going to follow me, you're going to have to make some cuts out of your life. Like, these old people are bad influences on you, and you got to get rid of them so that you can make whole new habits and be around new people and approach life in a different way." Jesus doesn't do any of that. He actually joins in the party as a way of encouraging Matthew that he's doing something positive. Now, certainly, there is wisdom in guarding your heart and making wise decisions about how to spend your time and the influences that exist in your life. And especially if you come out of a place of addiction or harmful behaviors and actions that have hurt you and others around you, you have to make drastic changes in order to make new pathways in life. But what I think Matthew shows us is that sometimes what God invites us to do is to allow our old friends to meet our new friend, and to allow our old friends to get to know this new friend that can change their lives just like this new friend has changed our lives. That's what Matthew does. He invites all his old friends, come and hang out with this guy that is going to and has been changing my life, and he can change yours as well. Jesus wasn't uncomfortable around messy people. In fact, the opposite is actually true. Messy people were really comfortable around Jesus. And part of the reason why is because Jesus wasn't condemning them like all the religious leaders around them were. Jesus had come to heal them. That's what grace can look like at the dinner table. That's the kind of love that can change lives. That not only then do we receive the care and compassion from Christ, then he invites us to embody it in the way that we serve and care for others around us. We take it in to then be able to give it out as well. Earlier this week, on Monday morning, in a news story you probably all have heard about by now, Pope Francis passed away after 12 years serving as the leader of the Roman Catholic Church. And one of the things that I always found really noteworthy about Pope Francis was his heart for the marginalized in society. This came out in a number of ways, one of which is that he decided to not live in the papal palace, but instead live in a guest house because he wanted his life to be closer oriented to ordinary people. And then a few years ago, during Holy Week on Maundy Thursday, functioning like Christ did to the disciples, he washed the feet of some female prisoners in the city of Rome as a way of embracing that posture of Christ. Now, don't get me wrong, we are not a Catholic church, and we have many disagreements with the Catholic Church about approaching Christ by faith specifically and what it means to come to God and be in relationship with him by faith. But I do believe that Pope Francis can be a really helpful model for us of what it looks like to care for the marginalized and the outsiders of our society. Here's how he described this kind of mentality. He said, openness to God makes us open towards the marginalized of this world and gives us the courage to leave the confines of our own security and comfort to become bruised, hurting, and dirty as we joyfully approach the suffering other in a spirit of solidarity. Isn't that what Jesus did at this party with Matthew? He was willing to become bruised and hurting and dirty around sinful people as a way of then joining with them to heal and provide hope and encouragement through his presence and love. Back in the early 1600s, there was a Roman named Caravaggio who created a painting based on the passage that we have been studying, The Calling of Matthew. He was famous as one of the founders of a Baroque style of painting, which became really influential at that period of time. Baroque painting is known for its dramatic use of light and darkness and shadows, intense emotion on faces, and displaying actions or movements on the part of the people that he portrays in the paintings. So the paintings are meant to feel like dramatic, theatrical, so that what seems ordinary actually becomes more extraordinary. It jumps off the page at you. So here's his painting titled The Calling of St. Matthew. I know it's very dark, especially because of the lights. It's hard to see, which is partly the effect and partly the lights, which makes it difficult to see. But what I want you to see in this dimly lit scene, which is meant to be like a counting house where Matthew is working, is that over on the right side, you have Jesus and Peter who are standing together. And over on the left side, you have Matthew and some fellow tax collectors that are working with him. And Jesus is standing there and he has his hand outstretched and he is pointing across the room over at Matthew. And Matthew is pointing directly back at himself, as if to say, "Me? You want me to follow you?" Like surprised by the question that Jesus is asking. The other thing that I want you to notice about the painting is that over on the right side, Jesus and Peter are dressed in clothing that would have been common at the time of Jesus' earthly ministry. Robes, almost looking like shepherds. But over on the left side of the painting, all of these tax collectors are dressed in nice clothing that would have been commonly worn in the 1600s. At the time that the painting was done. And what I think he's trying to portray is Jesus is not only pointing at Matthew and inviting him to follow him, he's pointing at everyone at that stage in time. He's reaching across time to say, "Come and follow me." He's reaching into our world across the spectrum of time through the presence of the Spirit to invite us to follow him as well. And I almost wonder if Caravaggio isn't kind of picturing himself as Matthew in the painting, because he had a horrible reputation in the early 1600s in Italy. He was known to be violent and provocative, and at one point he got in a street fight with another man that he killed. And he was tried and he was sentenced to death by Italian courts, and he was able to flee, and he spent the last 10 years of his life fleeing through various parts of Italy. He was not a man with a good reputation, and he probably felt that internal shame over his actions. And you can see how he could picture himself as Matthew, with Jesus pointing at him and him saying about himself, "Me? You're calling me? You want me to follow you?" And so I think the calling of Matthew and the posture of Jesus through the painting and through the text has three lessons that I think just really will stick with us this whole series, but are super evident this morning especially. The first is this: everybody's lost. Everybody's lost. Everybody is Matthew. Me? Me? You're calling me? Everybody is the tax collectors in the sinners in the story. The Bible says all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That means nobody is off to some advantage of being ahead of everybody else. Not the religious, not the morally upright, not the people who try really hard to do good. Jesus orients his ministry around those that the society around them has deemed as sinful, not because they're not worthy of grace from Jesus, but because they're not aware of their need. He orients his ministry around sinful people because they're the ones most aware of their need. And because they're the ones that then can respond to Christ and his invitation. The invitation of Jesus, I think, becomes for many of us like a mirror that is placed in front of us that allows us to see ourselves as we really are, broken. Take an honest look at yourself. You are, everybody is, lost. Lost. But that's not the whole part of the story, thankfully. Everybody's lost and everybody's loved. Loved, approached by Jesus. Just because you're lost and sinful doesn't mean you're beyond God's love and care and compassion. In fact, God's love isn't diminished by your failure in your sinfulness. In many ways, God's love is amplified. In the middle of our sin, as God is pouring out his love, as we're walking away from him, his love is even on more display as he draws us back in through his love. He meets us right where we are. His love isn't fragile. His love isn't conditional. It is based on the sure and certain work of Jesus, not based on our actions. Everybody's loved based on what Christ has done. He is strong enough to carry the weight of our sin, our shame, and our struggle, and he still invites us in. So everybody's lost, everybody's loved, and then really the invitation for all of us today is everybody's welcome at the table. Everybody's welcome at the table. No one is too far gone. No one is too broken or too messy for Jesus. And the invitation isn't based on your past performance. It's based on his present grace that's available to you to receive by faith right now. Jesus isn't hosting a party for the perfect. He's setting a place for the hungry who are aware of their need and want to take part in the feast that he is hosting. And if we're willing to come with open hands before him, he's more than willing to invite you and welcome you in. Isn't that just an amazing part of Jesus, that he doesn't require us to get cleaned up before he invites us in? He says, come as you are. He invites you to the table, into relationship with him, and then he begins his work of transformation. And so if you're here today and you're sitting here and you're thinking, I've made too many mistakes, I'm not spiritual enough, there's got to be better people that God would choose than me. If you're sitting here and some of those thoughts are kind of reverberating around in your minds, let the calling of Matthew be good news and an encouragement to you that you are exactly the kind of person that Jesus calls. The broken, the hurting, the sinful, the outsider, the overlooked are invited in to his feast. He invites you in not to shame you, but to love you, not to scold you, but to heal you. And all you have to do is accept his invitation. He's inviting you to follow. As we move toward our time of response, there's a prayer book that many of you know is meaningful to me. The Valley of Vision is a prayer book that was put together from various prayers written in the 1600s. And one of the prayers is, I think, really fitting for a day where we focus on we who are sinful are invited in to relationship, invited into a feast through the work of Jesus. And this prayer is titled, Need of Jesus, recognizing our need for him. And so I'll pray and then we'll lead into our time of response. Lord Jesus, I am blind, be my light. Ignorant, be my wisdom. Self-willed, be my mind. Open my ear to grasp quickly your Spirit's voice and delightfully run after his inviting hand. Melt my conscience so no hardness remains. Make it alive to evil's slightest touch. When Satan approaches, may I flee to your wounds and there cease to tremble at all alarms. Be my good shepherd to lead me into the green pastures of your word and cause me to lie down beside the rivers of its comforts. Your cross was raised to be my refuge. Your blood spilled to wash me clean. Your death occurred to give me assurance. Your name is written over me to save. I was a stranger, an outcast, a slave, a rebel, but your cross has brought me near. It has softened my heart. It has admitted me into your family and has made me an heir. Oh, that I may love you as you have loved me, that I may walk worthy of you, my Lord. May I always see your beauty with the clear eye of faith and feel the power of your Spirit in my heart. For unless he moves mightily in me, no inward fire will be kindled. Amen.